That's... Put on your helmet, fasten your chin strap, and get ready for the snuff. The Eric Ainge Show with Brian Rice is ready to go. Sports Animals VFL QB is ready to give you the insight and analysis that no one else in Tennessee radio can. Get in Eric's headset by calling 656-9900. 656-9900. The Eric Ainge Show with Brian Rice is headed your way right now.
It's a Thursday. It's the Eric Ainge Show. It's 11 o'clock. That means we get to play a little Florida, Alabama, or Georgia, Brian.
Indeed it does. It's presented on Thursdays by the Smoky Mountain Axe House and Axe Throw Thursday at the Smoky Mountain Axe House. SMAxes.com to book online. Always a fun thing to do on your weekend. I always recommend it every weekend.
I can't remember if my high score is 50 or 55.
I think it's 55.
Yeah. Try to beat that.
You know, it probably is 55 if I agreed that it was higher than you thought it was.
Yeah, I thought you might take the low-hanging fruit there and make it less than it was, even if you did know. I'm proud of you.
Not today.
Way to be honest, Brian.
All right, Florida, Georgia, or other? Florida, Georgia, or other are our three states today.
Okay.
I presume you're ready, and you don't have to get ready because you stay ready.
I don't know why you even ask.
All right. Florida, Georgia, or other? Woman has dream where her husband cheats on her, so she wakes up and stabs him.
Oh!
Woman has dream where her husband cheats on her, so she wakes up and stabs him. Did this happen in Florida, Georgia, or other?
Like, are we going with, like, knife? You can get stabbed with a lot of different objects.
It doesn't say knife, but it seems to suggest knife.
I mean, knife.
Usually,
play,
if it's not a knife, they list the weapon.
So she's just got a knife in her nightstand, mm-hmm. or under her pillow, like a psycho. Mm-hmm. Give me other on this because this doesn't really say Florida or Georgia to me. Gun plays Georgia. Sometimes machete plays Florida, but this is a knife stabbing. Give me other.
Joel?
This reminds me of a similar situation. Not identical, but similar, that happened between me and my own wife.
Wait, what?
Continue. Yeah, you guys aren't interested in that story. I'll say other.
Continue.
I'm extremely interested.
I
think we can all agree, as all three married men, that we 100% get blamed for things that our wives dream about.
So I guess before Brian gives the answer quick, what happened was my wife, she woke up in the middle of the night and her shoulder was hurting. And so then she went back to sleep and I guess she was still in pain, but she had a dream that I was a doctor and she woke up again and mentioned that her shoulder was hurting. And I asked if she needed anything and she's like, I think it's okay. But she like got mad at me because she was like, my husband's a doctor and I'm in pain. Why is he not helping me? And then she realized, wait a second. When did he go to medical school? What happened to that sports casting career? And then she kind of put two and two together that she dreamed it. So she didn't stab me. But yeah, that was kind of funny.
I was hoping it would be more of a stabbing thing than a dream thing.
Why?
Maybe a small puncture.
Yeah.
Not like a deep stab wound, but just like a little deep.
Anyway, I think every married man out there
knows.
I'm just
saying that was my
expectation.
I'm not saying that I thought it was me.
For something their wife dreamed about, or their actions in a dream their wife had. That's okay.
No, right. I get blamed for everything in this house.
This happened in Mississippi.
Over here in my cage.
Moselle, Mississippi. Even if you have a dream that seems 100% real, it's still just a dream. Apparently, 33-year-old Lindsay Stevens needed a refresher on that. She had a dream where her husband cheated on her. The dream felt so real that when she woke up, she grabbed a knife and stabbed him several times while he was sleeping. He needed surgery, but he's going to be okay. She was arrested for aggravated domestic assault.
Good for him?
Story number two.
She got in trouble.
Florida, Georgia, or other? Airline passenger punches a woman after her kids won't stop kicking his seat. Airline passenger punches a woman after her kids wouldn't stop kicking her seat.
So, so hold on. So a man.
No, a woman.
Who's getting.
Two women. Two women.
Okay. Sorry. I thought you said his. My bad.
Sorry. I may have. I did not mean to. But woman has kids on a flight. Kids are kicking another woman's seat. She responds with fisticuffs.
Oh, man. I'm just trying to put myself in this position right now. And if my kids, because they do kick people's seats. Mm-hmm.
Kids do.
And I tell them to stop. But at some point, you're dad of three and you just don't care. So whatever. If that was happening and a woman turned around to say probably anything to my wife, that would have been not good for her.
Yeah.
Kelly's an air marshal, so she probably would have pulled the strap out and ended that quick.
It would not have worked out well.
Give me other as well. Give me other.
Joel?
Yeah, I'll take other. Something like this could have happened anywhere.
Well, you get credit because it is both Georgia and other. A Spirit Airlines flight from Atlanta to Oregon.
Hey!
Had to be
That's
stopped.
Where all the crazies are.
29-year-old Deidrina Walker-Williams was on a Spirit Airlines flight to Portland, Oregon on Sunday. Two little kids behind her wouldn't stop kicking her seat. One of them 3, one of them 7. She asked the mom to handle it more than once. The mom ignored her, so Deidrina waited for the plane to land, grabbed her luggage from the overhead bin, and then attacked the mom. She landed 2 or 3 punches. The woman ended up with injuries to her head and lip. Deidrina admitted to it, telling cops, "You just have to, quote, do what you gotta do," unquote, in that situation.
No remorse. Wow.
Nope.
I mean, at least she didn't try to, fabricate the story. I mean, she owned
it. No. They did it. Why are you not more angry at them? Yeah, that was a bold tragicod. We'll see how it pays off. Last one. Florida, Georgia, or other. Man arrested for robbery has a Sharpie mustache in his mugshot. Man arrested for robbery has a curly Sharpie mustache in his mugshot.
How old is the guy?
I'm going to say 28.
28?
Oh, man, I was close.
Okay, that's Florida. Yeah, can't grow a mustache, Florida.
You know, I'm also going I'm thinking, how ballsy that would have been to get a tattoo of that. To tattoo a curly mustache on that. I'm sure somebody in the world has it.
Probably.
But a Sharpie. I've caught my 7-year-old doing that. And then I have to have the whole conversation about why you don't want tattoos.
But, Dad, you have them.
Do as I say, not as I did.
Yeah.
So, I, too, am going to go with Joel on this one. I'm going to go Florida. This has Florida to me.
This happened to a 28-year-old man named Tyler Cribbs from Astor, Florida. He was arrested earlier this week for stealing a friend's wallet and phone. In his mugshot, he has a curly black mustache drawn in Sharpie on his face. No word on where the mustache came from. Looks like something you would have drawn on you if you passed out drinking. He has kind of a smirk in his mugshot that really accentuates the Sharpie mustache. And that's how you play Florida, Alabama, or Georgia. It's brought to you every Thursday on an Axe Throw Thursday by the Smoky Mountain Axe House.
SMAxes.com.
You can book online there. The Eric Haines Show continues next.
About what's going on, just because the fan doesn't want a 3-10 year, they think something needs to be done over there, doesn't mean we have to change coaches over 3 or 4 years. The problem is, and I appreciate you letting me speak, it's not that we have to change coaches every 3 or 4 years. I think it goes beyond that. We need to look and see how we're hiring these coaches. We got the wrong people hiring them. We look at the wrong thing. Why? I mean, I think listen all my life to some radio stations. I don't believe I've ever had anybody, heard anybody calling in that they want to hire Butch Jones. No, I'm talking about the fans. I don't believe I've ever heard any fans calling in they want to hire Dooley. or the one we've got right now. I think you got to look at the resume. And I don't understand our athletic director when he's looking at this guy's resume, even though he's been a good defensive coach, he's been a good defensive back coach. What was on his resume, guys, that will tell you if you would hire somebody, this guy could come in Tennessee and rebuild our program and do a good job. I mean, unless there's something I'm missing, what are we looking at when we hire some of these guys? And some of the people that I've known that the fans calling in wanting this person, that person, has been turned out to be a pretty darn good coach. But we skipped on every one of them and took the advice of whoever over there at the administration took the advice of hiring some of these coaches that we've hired. I don't know any university, especially somebody like Tennessee, should be hiring any of these coaches that we've been hiring. And you go back and look at the resume, and I'm serious, guys, there's nothing on this guy's resume to prove to you that he can come in and be a head coach.
Well, there's nothing on resume of any person who hasn't been a head coach that says they're definitely going to be a successful head coach. There wasn't anything on Dabo Swinney's resume at Clemson that suggested he was going to be a good head coach when he took over as a member of that staff when Tommy Bowden was fired. They promoted him. He finished out the season okay, and then he had a couple of middling years before he found a game changer at quarterback, and now he's won multiple national championships. I think the resume is what it is when you've improved, as Jeremy Pruitt had. He improved defenses to be national championship caliber defenses at Florida State and at Alabama, and then improved defense greatly in the 1 year he was at Georgia. That suggests to you that he's a good coach, and he's able to connect with kids, and he's able to connect with them quickly. I agree that Derek Dooley should have been hired at Tennessee. But I would say this. Okay, but my point is, when you hire any person who has not been a head coach, there is nothing on their resume that guarantees they're going to be a success. There are things that you point to, like being able to improve every place they've been, to say, well, if we bring him in as head coach, there's a good chance he improves where we are. I think when you look at the top 10 teams in college football right now, the only ones that have hired a proven championship-level head coach are Alabama and Texas A&M. They're the only two programs on that list that hired a coach that had won a championship. Clemson promoted an assistant. Ohio State promoted an assistant. Notre Dame hired Brian Kelly, who had had some success at Cincinnati, but ultimately hadn't won championships. I mentioned Texas A&M with Jimbo Fisher. Oklahoma with Lincoln Riley promoted an assistant. Florida hired Dan Mullen, who had had some success at Mississippi State, had been as successful as anybody had been at Mississippi State, but ultimately had not won a championship. Cincinnati hired Luke Fickell, who had had some success as an interim coach at Ohio State, but ultimately Ohio State passed on giving him the job. Ohio State hired Matt Campbell, who had been an assistant. Georgia hired Kirby Smart, who had been an assistant with an almost identical resume to Jeremy Pruitt. So when you look at what other schools have done, what Tennessee has done in its last two head coaching searches is not different than teams that have had success. It's also not different from a lot of teams that haven't had success in hiring coaches. But, Eric, I don't think you can say that Tennessee's obviously been incompetent in hiring coaches, particularly when they've targeted some of the people they've targeted, when you look at what schools that have been successful have done.
The main problem with us and getting which coach that we end up with every time is the only coaching search that we have had where the athletic director making the hire knew exactly what he was going to do and had a plan and pulled it off was when Mike Hamilton fired Philip Fulmer and immediately had Lane Kiffin.
Yeah.
He wanted to go younger. He wanted an up-and-comer. That was what he wanted to do. He had a plan. Then he executed the plan. Then Lane leaves and we're holding, just sitting around not knowing what to do. You're in a bad situation. You end up getting a guy named Derek Dooley. You're getting rid of Dooley.
You should have been hired. There's no defense still for that one.
No. And then Dooley tries to leave and you have a little time to try to figure it out. Excuse me. but you start getting turned down by all the big name coaches in the country because they look at what a mess the program is and they don't want to hitch their success career wagon to a rebuild and all the stuff we going on here. So who do you get? You get an up-and-comer from Cincinnati who wants the job, and at least he wanted it, and that's Butch Jones. Butch Jones did some good things for a few years. The job was too big for him. Then you have to fire him, and you're trying to decide what you're going to do and how that's going to go down, and the coaching search and the athletic department go crazy, and you end up getting the best coordinator available. Because once again, just like when you hired Butch, a lot of people didn't want the job.
Yeah, Pruitt people did. Turned down more money than they ended up taking at their current schools to go coach somewhere else or to stay somewhere else.
What's disheartening for me right now is, you know, when you see Chris Lowe's reports and that maybe this investigation is too big for Jeremy Pruitt to climb out of, even if it's not firing him for cause, the effects that it could have on his program could be one, you know, a direct result to what his final undoing is. I mean, I could see that being the case. I get it. The frustrating part is what it does to the football program, because if you just had a bunch, all those recruits and young players and talent and resources that they have here, if Pruitt just didn't win and there wasn't other stuff going on in the program, then I think it would be a very attractive job for a lot of people. I think it would be any new job's a challenge, but I don't think you'd have to be settling for just a coordinator or a coach that didn't have success somewhere else. I don't think you'd have to go that route. I think you'd be able to go with big money. You'd be able to go out and land somebody good. You know, if Auburn was in as bad a shape as everyone's saying Tennessee might be, Brian Harsin probably doesn't take that job.
No, he's not leaving Boise State where he's built so much success.
It's kind of like Chris Peterson got every job offer in the world from
including Tennessee
Boise State.
Twice.
Yeah, from when he was at Boise State, he got every time there was a hot board for anybody, Peterson's name was right there at the top, and it took him forever just to go to, you know, a few hours away to go to Washington. I mean, like, it's just, these guys don't leave now just to leave. A Tennessee offer job, and I'm just being honest, doesn't hold enough weight to coaches in the coaching world that if it doesn't make sense completely, that they're willing to take the job. That was obviously not the case years ago, but now with all the TV money and all the ways to compensate people and at smaller schools, I mean, Matt Campbell could coach at Iowa State for the next 20 years and then retire, 30 years.
He's turned down huge money from other places to leave, and it's thought now that the only places he would leave for are the NFL or Ohio State. You know, that Ohio State job isn't coming open.
No, exactly. I mean, just, but you know, to my point, Iowa State can pay him enough money, even if it's not as much as Ohio State could or one of these other schools, but they can still pay him pretty fair market value to stay there. That didn't, you know, Dabo Sweeney would have had to leave Clemson years ago if it was the old model. Now the Clemson head football coach can be one of the highest paid coaches in the entire country. When I played football, when I played even in the early to mid 2000s, that was not the case.
Yeah.
Now it is. So you just, I don't know, if the job needs to be attractable. And I know people don't want to hear it, but all the constant bashing of coaches and players, it doesn't help. Does it hurt? Maybe not. Maybe not. I don't know. But when you look at how, when you go online and look at how a portion of our fan base, the things they would say about Jarrett Garantano, a guy who played here, didn't play great, he didn't play good enough. He didn't. He didn't get developed good enough. His career didn't end up like he or you or I would have wanted it to. But he deserved zero of the hate and just horrible things that were said to him via social media. And if I'm a high school kid, I'm being honest. If I were a high school kid and this existed, and I saw how our fan base talks about some of our own players and coaches, I would immediately wipe it off. I'd be like, well, I'm not going there. That's crazy. What's he done for people to send him death threats? I mean, like, seriously, what people are harassing his little sister? Who has nothing to do with how he plays or not? The whole thing is...
And it's not a lot of people doing that, but when it's
no,
some...
No, it's a small portion, but...
When it's anybody, it makes the rest of us look bad. And that's what I was saying earlier. The idea that we turn to anger and going after people when they don't play good right away is not unique, but it also is not productive in any way.
That's why you're right. That's why when I was talking about Pruitt today, I said if you're going to fire him for cause, then you have to fire him. I mean, if he deserves to be fired for something that he or his staff did, then fire him. If you're going to keep him, then there's a few things that need to have a clear-cut understanding on and very specific to what you need to do to continue being the coach here and get everything and everybody calmed down. And if that wasn't done, you know, then I would fire him. And that's not me calling for his job. That's just me saying you're going to have a pretty long list of pretty hard to achieve things that you need to do. You know, is it realistic for you to be the head coach long term with that? It's not probable, maybe, because this is going to be pretty hard, but you're here, you dug in, you've recruited the guys that are here. I'm going to give you a chance to do it. That's kind of where I would, that's where I would come in, I think, if I were Coach Fulmer. But again, we there's a lot of stuff that's still pending in the air right now.
Yeah. The issue with hiring coaches is not a reason to not make a change either. Whether it's now, whether it's Tennessee, whether it's Auburn, whether it's whatever. The inexact science of coaching searches is also not a reason to not make a change if you feel like you need to. So I don't want anybody to hear me say, well, it's hard to hire somebody and it's inexact, so we shouldn't do it. That's not what I'm saying at all. But what I am saying is rolling out that it's always bad and we're always doing things that are wrong when you look at the rest of college football is just not accurate. When you look at the top 10 teams in the college football playoff rankings, what did they do to get their head coach? You know, other than Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher, there's not a can't miss guy on the list. And Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban don't come along every day because how many active coaches are there that have a national championship? Well, it's a short list, and two of them are at schools where they can't win one anymore. Les Miles and Mack Brown. You know, you're looking at Nick Saban, Dabo, Les Miles, Mack Brown, Jimbo Fisher, and Ed Orgeron. So you got two guys in there that are proven, two guys that are on the back end of their career, and a guy that has a national championship, but you wouldn't hire to coach your team tomorrow. Would you hire Ed Orgeron to be your head coach tomorrow? I would say most schools wouldn't.
They're in a similar position.
Mm-hmm. They're in a similar position right now. They're a year removed from a national championship, and their fans are furious. So, and they just fired both of their coordinators that had been there for 1 year. So it's not easy. That's not a reason not to do anything.
No, it's an uphill battle. I guess I would just say I've seen enough good things that I'm willing to see if he can rechannel that.
Yeah. Anyway, so we'll roll on. We'll talk a little Tennessee, Arkansas. We'll have some positive on the other side. A little Tennessee, Arkansas. That's next on the Eric Haines Show.
Welcome back into the Eric Haines Show, 865-656-9900. Big win for the Vols last night, Brian.
It was a bounce back for Tennessee as they rallied from a halftime deficit to defeat Arkansas 79-74. High point men, Josiah Jordan James and Victor Bailey Jr., 17 points each. Both had two three-pointers made. Folke came up big as well, 16 points. Keon Johnson, 14. So four Vols in double figures, a lot of production. And Fulkerson was in and out of the lineup with his hand, but seems to be okay and played like it last night.
Yeah, I got so scared. When he went up to dunk that ball after the whistle blew and he landed weird on his knee, I thought for sure he was going. They took him to the back, and I was like, oh, he's done. So the announcers were saying the same thing. They're like, oh, that doesn't look good.
Yeah.
And then he comes back out and does Folke stuff. It was a good bat. It was a good team win last night. You know, we didn't necessarily do any – no, we played good defense, forcing turnovers, and we took care of the basketball. And that's the reason we were able to win the game, because when they did get possessions, when they didn't turn it over, they knocked the shots down almost every time.
Yeah.
So creating all those, you know, more possessions for Tennessee is what ended up winning them the game. You know, if we have 10 turnovers instead of 5, we probably don't win that game.
Yeah. No, I think you're right.
That's really good. A 20-5 turnover ratio is really good. You know, or 4-1 turnover ratio, I guess is how you'd say that. That's really, really good. And Josiah Jordan James, man, he had the quietest 17 ever. He's just such a Swiss Army knife and does so many different things. Like, I didn't even realize he had 17 points until the game was over.
Yeah.
You know, Victor Bailey's always a little louder because he's one-on-one. It's pull-up jumpers. It's, you know, Josiah Jordan James is getting little put-back layups, knocked down a couple threes, a couple jumpers, some free throws. And the next thing you know, he's got 17 points, and he was for sure the MVP of the game.
Yeah. So a good bounce back for Tennessee after the loss to Alabama over the weekend. Still going to have to work out some things on the offensive side, and you mentioned it earlier in the show. The getting beat off the dribble is something that has to get fixed.
They have to. They, for as good as we are at defense, I mean, it's hard. So out of one side of my mouth, I'm going to say we need to improve defensively, and then while we're like a top 10 defensive team in the country and force 20 turnovers.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but I'm not talking about being good enough to beat Arkansas in a close one. I'm talking about there's going to be teams we're going to play throughout the year and towards the end of the year that no matter how good we play on defense, they're not going to turn it over 20 times.
Yeah.
We're not going to get that many more possessions than those other teams. And if they're knocking down shots and getting by us, beating us off the dribble, we won't win those games. So that's kind of where my method comes in here. I'm going, I get it. We're getting away right now. Well, not against Alabama. They went ahead and beat us. But we got away with getting beat off the dribble again. We do need to fix that. Or I don't care. You could have two pawns out there. Guys are still going to be getting layups and shooting open jumpers. And we can't win towards the end of the year doing that. So they've got to fix the on-ball defense.
Yeah. And I think something you said there is right. Well, a lot that you said there was right, but that you can't count on forcing that many turnovers every game and having that many more possessions. I think when you look back at the Alabama game, that's what got you was there were plenty of times that you got stops and went down with a chance to make it a three-point ball game or a two-point ball game or at least stay in the game, and you didn't. And that's something that they're going to have to continue to address and continue to try to fix.
Yeah, and I think they can do it. I mean, as good as they are on defense as a team, I mean, here's the thing. If they fix their on-ball defense with as good as they play help defense, and when guys are getting the ball kicked out to them, there's a guy right there in their face, and everything is contested, teams won't shoot like they're shooting against us right now.
Yeah.
It won't happen. And then we'll be forcing them to expend all their energy trying to guard us on offense when we have the ball. And we're dishing it around to everybody. I think we'd be better off if we played the whole year kind of like we are right now, where we have four guys that average in double figures and two or three more guys that are just underneath it, 7 a game, 6 a game, 8 a game, you know, with the highest guy averaging, you know, 13 to 15 points. If we have all of our starters and the first two off the bench approaching double digits on any given night, then we're going to win way more games than we're going to lose. So I do kind of like that. Like, we don't have one guy that, oh, man, he's off tonight. We're screwed. What are we going to do? You never run into that problem.
And my expectations for them, by the way, haven't changed at all based on the last two games. They're still, I think they're still one of, if not the best team in the SEC, likely to be the best team in the SEC. They just have to go out and continue proving it. And the schedule from here gets a little easier over the next few weeks, try to build some momentum and try to build and be able to work on some things as you try to push on forward. Coming up next, they have Texas A&M on the road on Saturday, then at Columbia, South Carolina next Tuesday, and then home for Vanderbilt a week from Saturday. And then they head to Florida. Three road games, but I think three very winnable road games. And then a home game against Vanderbilt, who's the worst team in the conference. I think you're going to have a real chance to do that.
They're not really road games. I mean, they are. You have to get on a plane, and you got to fly there, and then you got to get off the plane and go to a hotel. But other than the actual act of flying on the plane, it's not really an away game. It's not a hostile crowd.
No, it'll be smallish
hardly
crowds.
Anybody, yeah, hardly anybody in there.
Yeah. So you'll have an opportunity. I think this is a good opportunity to build momentum, and hopefully they can do that and get it back to rolling the way that it looked like it was rolling a little earlier this season.
I was glad to see that we had a little bit of – we were struggling there for a little bit, and we didn't freak out, didn't overreact, didn't overcoach or adjust. We made some small adjustments, came out in the second half to start, and lit it up. And that is really good to see. If one of our branding slogans for this team this year, people say, man, they're a second half team. That first 5 minutes out of the gate, you better bring it, because they're like, that would be awesome for us. We erased a 7-point deficit like that. So they did good.
Yeah, it was a good bounce back for them. So. We'll see how they carry it into this weekend as well. We'll come back. We'll find out what we learned today and get you set for the rest of your sports day next on the Eric Haines Show.
My opinion on what I would do if I was our athletic director, Philip Fulmer, what I would need to hear from Pruitt. Again, this is assuming that the investigation doesn't take his job.
Yeah.
Because that's every day it goes on. And you said something like time frame, like we need an answer.
The uncertainty is as damaging as anything right now, because you need to be hiring assistant coaches. You need to be making a decision on some assistant coaches that you may not want to keep any longer, and you need to be able to replace them and continue building your program. And every day you can't do that is damaging to your program.
Yeah.
And I think Phil Fulmer knows that, and I think the rest of the administration knows that, but you know, it hasn't made it go any faster. And so I think, you're going to have to decide, okay, if we have to fire him later, we have to fire him later. But right now, we've got to empower him to hire who he needs and get this program moving and try to bring in transfers, because it's time.
Yeah, I mean, you got to know. You can't just sit around not knowing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where I am. You got to give him some certainty, and if there's an investigation, there are results that later on you have to do something else, that's fine. But right now, you either give a vote of confidence or say you're moving on, because otherwise you're going to have this program hamstrung for weeks and months to come, and that can't happen. You're setting yourself up for failure this year if you do that.
No one wants that to happen. You know, we also talked about Tennessee basketball a bunch. Good team win. Like Victor Bailey and James both having 17, that was good. Viscovi played probably the worst game he's played all year, but that's okay. I mean, he's just going to have to figure out I don't want to call him a liability on defense, because a lot of times he plays off enough that guys just try to shoot over him, and that's not ideal either, but it's a whole lot better than a clear path to the basket. We've got to fix our on-ball defense. If we want, and forcing them to where the help actually is, taking away their strong hand, force them to their offhand, all that kind of basic stuff. We got to get better at that, or we're going to struggle when we play against teams that can defend us just as well as we can defend them.
Yep. And let's see, what else did we learn? We learned that negativity is bad. Negativity and anger. Anger in negativity is bad, and it is exhausting.
Yeah, sometimes it's warranted, too. You know, like, a lot of people are mad for a reason, and they have good points, and I understand it. I'm honestly, I agree with most of the callers that call like that. I guess I live in the, unless the investigation gets him, he's probably going to be the coach next year. So if that's the case, then what are we talking about? As opposed to just sitting, living in the fire and fire and fire and fire and fire and fire him all day, every day. None of that will actually make him get fired. So it's wasted energy. So I'm trying to focus my energy on, well, what does he actually need to do?
Yeah.
What are things that could be done? What are some changes he needs to make from a control standpoint? Letting go a little bit. Let the coaches do their jobs. There's a lot of stuff that he needs to get better at if it's actually going to work out.
Yeah. I think where Jeremy Pruitt was this year, as far as getting involved in places that he probably should have left it to the experts, was it came out of a place of, this isn't working. What can I do to fix it? Because I see this is going badly. And at some point, you just have to trust the people that you hired to do it and finish it. And if you have to do something else when the season's over, you have to do something else when the season's over. But you got to trust your guys. And I think that's a lesson that he's had a tough time learning as a head coach. And hopefully, if he is going to continue, we'll apply that lesson a little better after what happened this year.
Agreed.
Coming up tomorrow on the show, we'll be live at Rusty Wallace Honda. We will be on Callahan Drive, on one side of Callahan Drive or the other, every Friday for the rest of the year. So if you're making Friday plans and you want to come see us over the rest of the year, then that's a good place to do it. You know, we'll be somewhere on Callahan Drive every Friday. Looking forward to it.
100%.
And looking forward to Eric being able to get out of the basement tomorrow.
That's right.
The basement. I'm in the basement. You're in the garage.
Yeah, I moved it inside, but it's still not. I still don't like doing it here.
Yeah, it's a little chilly in the
garage. Open the studio up.
Well, we know it won't be for a while.
I know. I get it.
Just keep on rolling.
I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
Yeah. And that's usually worse. All right, we'll see you tomorrow. Joel, thank you. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate you interacting today. And we hope that you choose to do so tomorrow. We'll see you then on the Eric Haines Show.